Welcome to Seagull Eagle, the podcast where South Coast meets South London, one known for fish and chips and the other for chicken shops.
Yeah, this is the podcast where neither of us will ever win the league, but we'll talk like we might. The international break is over and the Premier League is back.
This week at Palace, we hosted Sunderland at home and Palace unveiled new signings, but Sunderland unveiled a brick wall.
And at Brighton, we took a short trip to the Vitality Stadium and came away with two bad injuries, one goal and 0 points.
Plus, we'll go over all the latest club news and preview the upcoming fixtures for both Palace and Brighton.
Because this is Seagull Eagle.
Hello, Neil.
Hello, mate. How are you?
Oh, very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm very good. I've been refreshed this week. I was away on holiday. I had a lovely time.
Where'd you go?
I went to Lake Como.
Oh, someone's changed. Oh. That's not Benidorm, is it, on an all-inclusive? Someone's doing all right for themselves, Neil.
I tell you, this podcast, it's making me millions, mate.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Absolutely, I haven't seen none of it. Look at that. Mate, I'm glad you've had a nice break.
Thank you. Thank you. How are you? Good week?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah. All good. Was at the Palace yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was worth the trip. But
yeah. I mean, if we could do a podcast not talking about football, it probably would have been a better week, really. But
certainly if you're a Brighton fan, yeah.
Well, look, we are where we are. Let's get straight into it. Crystal Palace played Sunderland on Saturday.
We did.
Yeah. How many did you get past them?
For a change, we didn't.
For a change,
we had a bit of a day off up front yesterday, and I think quite understandably, actually,
right,
given the situation with Adam Walton, Saar. And obviously, it's only the second game probably in the Premier League without Eze as well.
Yeah, good point.
So if you think about the fact that I think it was something like 60% of our goals came from Saar and Eze last year.
Oh, right. Okay,
when you take that into consideration and think about the fact that obviously Wharton is also injured, we add Lerma into midfield for this game, and our new signing, Jeremy Pino, had his first home debut. So he stepped in for the first time. Bearing in mind, he only got, I think, 10 minutes at Villa for that game last week. I think it was we're going through, I wouldn't say a period of change, but we've got to get these new guys in, which hasn't been helped by the fact that they can't be kind of slowly put in.
No.
They've got to be played because there's not really many other options.
That's a fair point. We talked a little bit about it last week, didn't we, when we said about the fact that, you know, once Eze goes, okay, you've only lost one officially outfield player in that sense, but he was a big part of your team and did things that nobody else could.
Yeah.
And Jeremy Pino is not going to be that type of player. He's a different player. I wonder if you could explain it to me. I don't know if it did. Did Glasner change anything? Did the style change or the formation in any way? Was there any sort of structural changes?
Not particularly that I noticed.
Right.
I think that Pino's just a very different player to Eze, but I'm really excited by him. I genuinely am, as I am with Uche, who's the other guy. We only saw 10 minutes of him.
Oh, okay.
In the press conference, Glasner did say that the new players, obviously because Canva was on the bench, the 19-year-old defender. So them three actually only had half a day's training session because of the international break.
Yeah.
In my head, you kind of think, oh, they've had a week off, and you know, but obviously, you know, like Uche's just come back from his international game with Nigeria and all the other bits and pieces. So yeah, he basically said they've only had like half a day on the training field together. So whilst they're fit, they don't, you know, it's like a brand new friend turning up at the park and you're working out where they are on the pitch, you know. They're going to need a bit of time. But it wasn't a disaster, Neil. If anything, I think the reason that it finished 0-0 was thanks to some genuine heroics from the Sunderland keeper, is the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
You know, like when, and I know that you've talked about this a few times with a couple of Brighton losses in the near distant past, where when you either lose or don't win a game, you either attribute it to we played awfully or wow, weren't they good?
Yeah.
And it kind of wasn't either one of them two. It was their keeper And technically, their defensive play was superb.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at the stats, and yeah, you're absolutely right. I think even the highlights on Match of the Day and other things that I've looked at when I've looked at the game replayed, and you can see the type of game it turned out to be, you know, quite rightly, the home team going for it as much as they can. I think goalkeeper saves, I think you're right. I think he made like six actual full-on saves.
Well, he had six shots on target and he made six saves.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to talk me through little bits? Is there anything in particular you want to talk about in the game?
I mean, let's start from the beginning. We hadn't lost a Premier League game in nine going into the game, which even at that point was the longest run of all Premier League teams so far. Obviously, I'm assuming that Sunderland weren't particularly looking forward to coming to play us at the moment. So I think chances were at a premium throughout that first half is the truth. I think they had a reasonable chance at the beginning.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, looking at it as a spectator and then also when I watched it back later on this afternoon, I don't think there was ever a moment that I was like, we're in trouble here. Mm. Does that make sense?
There was a couple
of like, oh, have we got it? Yeah, we got it. But I think the defence have kind of, they are so established and obviously Gaye's back now. But like it was all, there was never any doubt in my mind that they were going to score. I didn't think that we were going to let one in. I think the situation that we had, it was more about how do we convert defence to attack. And that's why we've been so good recently. But if you have a look at them games where we win them 2-3-0, nine times out of 10, that's all come from the likes of Wharton and Saar.
Yeah.
So that was the bit for me, which was not worried about the back. Mateta, not worried about, because if he gets the ball, great. It's the bit in the middle that turns defence into attack so quickly. It felt like we were, there was kind of almost like a block in the chain a little bit in that kind of change from defence to attack where you get the break. That person who gets that ball, normally it's an immediate ball forward into space. Someone's running onto it. And before you know it, someone's kicking a corner flag somewhere.
Yeah.
This time there was quite a lot of sideways balls or no, back to defence and we go again.
Yeah.
So it felt a little bit like the options weren't always there.
That's the Adam Wharton effect, isn't it? I mean, that is one of the things I've always noticed watching Palace is as soon as the ball goes to Wharton, he knows where your players are going to be. He knows particularly where Mateta and Saar, mainly Saar I've noticed as well, they have a really good connection. Both of those players not on the pitch, you know, that's going to have a huge impact on your transition from one to the other. So,
but it's that wonder of Wharton, if you watch his game really, really closely, he very rarely passes it to a player.
Yeah.
He'll pass it into space.
Absolutely.
Because he knows where that run's going to come from. And as I say, look, you know, we've got Pino who was, in essence, he's the playmaker, right?
Sure.
And he's there. He's got the pace. He's got the ability. He's technical. Bless him, though, he's small.
Yeah.
Right. And he's small and he does look like a 19-year-old kid who's kind of, when you stand him next to some of them big ex-championship defenders of Sunderland who look like they're about to eat him, like he was being knocked off the ball quite easily. He's got to adapt a little bit to the Premier League, I think, is what we're trying to say here. However, we were creating some good stuff. There was some brilliant midfield play.
Right.
There were some great moments. That flipping keeper just kept on getting in the way. And I don't know how he did it. Truthfully, if that keeper was having an average normal game, we would have walked away 3-0.
Sunderland have done well, full stop, since they've come into the league. I think they've played really well. And we were talking about this last week, weren't we? And I thought it'd be a close affair. I still thought you'd snatch it. But I think, you know, Sunderland, they obviously came there with a game plan. And it sort of paid off, basically.
It did. It did. Obviously, as we said, defensively strong. And I think also Mateta was kept busy. So I think, and this is something that you normally get from the teams that come up from the Championship.
Mm.
You know, like when there's that style of play that I'm used to as a Palace fan from my old season ticket days when we were in the Championship and you're at Stoke on a Wednesday cold night and, you know, all you're seeing is the defenders elbowing the players out, pushing, and every time the ref's back's turned, someone's, you know, giving someone a nudge or whatever. It's that kind of Vinnie Jones style football, right?
Yeah.
And there was certainly a lot of that going on from Sunderland. And this isn't me, by the way, as a Palace fan going filthy. What this is actually me saying is, I think Sunderland did it brilliantly in defence, and I didn't like it, but they kept Mateta busy. They didn't give him space. They knew that when the balls came out quick from defence and there was a break coming on, they knew where them balls were going to go.
Sure.
And I think they definitely done their homework, but also they just annoyed us. They annoyed the attackers, and I think they managed to get enough people back quick enough to stop our attacks. So, as I said, if Roofs, I think his name is, had an average game, it probably would have been 3-0. I think I don't know whether he did officially get man of the match, but he should have. And to be fair to him, he should have been awarded a cape at the end of that. But the team, all in all, looked very well organised from Sunderland, very defensively strong. And I would be amazed if they end up getting relegated.
Yeah.
I can't see it, mate. I really can't. If they can come to a team like us on decent form, and I mean, yes, there's change, but, you know, not enough to put us off. We beat Villa 3-0 last week. Mm. So I think it's very much, they turned up, they had a game plan, they were organised, and the only thing they didn't have, truthfully, was a talisman up front who could hit the target.
Yeah.
So I think we had our best chance at 20 minutes. Kamada, I thought, had a decent game. He was being played slightly out of position.
He was more attacking, wasn't he, than normal?
He was kind of he was being played more on the left, and he's much better central. And obviously, later on in the game, when Deveni came on and he played kind of more over to the left, Kamada felt a lot more balanced, and Kamada had a lot more. His ability showed a lot more in that position.
Yeah.
But I think he was playing some beautiful balls forward, as was Pino. But Kamada played this lovely weighted ball ahead of Pino, just like Walton would have, truthfully, who ran to perfection. And Pino, bless him, on his debut, as he was running, you could see his face going, "This is the moment, this is the moment." And he basically beaten the keeper, like the keeper was in front of him.
Yeah, I saw this.
It went just to the left-hand side of the post. And ironically, there was two other players to the right of him that he could have passed it to. And if it wasn't his debut, I promise you now he would have passed it.
Yeah, I noticed this as well. It was a really good move. And he almost had too much time, didn't he? It was one of those where you're just faced with the goalkeeper and you suddenly think, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And he's probably thinking exactly the same thing. What the hell am I going to do? And he had about three different choices. And in the end, it was a close effort. But
I mean, do you know what the funny thing is? Some people have given him some stick for that on his debut, right?
Really?
They've given him some stick for that online. And Glasner came out at the end of it, which was quite rightly was like, does anyone remember Eze for the first 15 games of the season who couldn't hit a barn door?
Yeah.
Who had like 24 shots on target and didn't get one in. This guy I thought he was brilliant. I really did. And I think that give him more than 90 minutes on an English Premier League football pitch, he's going to be superb. I promise you now, give it a couple of years, it'll be off to one of the biggest clubs in Europe for 80 million.
Yeah.
I genuinely don't doubt it. So anyway, we had that chance. And then defensively, we let them in a few times. But as I said earlier, never really felt like they were going to do much.
No, because I mean, you could see the chances that they had. They were getting into good positions, the odd position, but they were getting into good positions. But then their shooting was horrific. I mean, as soon as they got into any sort of opportunity,
but we closed them down well, which is what good defensively, because we don't give people space to shoot. The only goals we really let in is when someone hasn't done their job properly and they've got a load of space to think about where they're going to put it.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing we did. But obviously, that's also another thing they did well, right?
Yeah.
They didn't give any of our team much space. So anyway, into the second half. By the way, at half time, I did sit there watching an epically loud Crystal Palace cheerleader performance. We've got a new sound system at Palace now. Really, do you remember, I sit round by all the old men who get their sandwiches out of their lunchbox and read the paper at half time. And there was a lot of moaning going on about how loud it was. I say it was epically loud. No louder than it should be, to be fair, but a lot louder than the old system.
They changed ours at the Amex last season. And it's so much louder. It's ridiculous. You can hardly hear yourself talk. So
But anyway, old man ran over.
Sorry.
At half time, I think the general consensus around the stadium was this is probably going to be a bore draw. Like it was, you couldn't really see us making much headway on it and you couldn't really see us letting one in. So, and it felt like if it was going to go anywhere, it like someone would walk away with the three, like Sunderland might rob it, but probably not. we should probably get what we deserve, but I couldn't see it. Mm. I just couldn't see it. Anyway, Mateta had a couple of early chances. Great dummy from Pino. And then there was also a second from a cross by Mitchell. On both occasions, though, Roofs was the first to the ball. This is the problem. Yeah. He was just all over it.
He was very good.
Deveni came on for Lerma, gave us a bit more going forward, as I said earlier. I think, and that's one thing that we haven't seen much, which is that kind of attacking substitution from Glasner, having the options to do that. Lerma was being played in midfield instead of defence, right?
Sure, sure.
More of a midfielder. But when Deveni came on, it did feel a lot more attacking. And then there was a later substitution, which we'll talk about in a minute, which was another further attacking substitution. So it does feel like we've got a few more, even though we've got people injured, we've got a bit more Arsenal on the bench. Not literally Arsenal, but yeah. And then I think Sunderland in that last 15 minutes started to look a bit tired, Neil.
Right.
And that's when I did believe that we might get something. But yet more ridiculous saves from Roof. Then we got a chance to see Uche, the new guy that I was really excited about, because he's this guy that we've signed. To be honest, I mean, I'd heard of Jeremy Pino. I'd seen Jeremy's YouTube reels and all this. When Uche came in, I didn't know him from Adam. Like, I'd no idea what we'd signed. I'd heard what we'd signed. So it's really interesting when you kind of see this player on the pitch. What's he going to be like? What's he going to bring us? Pino came off, and I think bearing in mind that he didn't play his international games because he had a bit of an ankle injury, so I was surprised he played 80 minutes, to be fair. He came off to a big round of applause from the Palace fans. So obviously Uche got 10 minutes, and what I saw, Neil, I liked.
He's a big fella, isn't he, for starters?
Mate, you don't want to mess with him. He's big, he's strong, really direct play. And do you know what? Like, if his footballing style was a statement, it'll be something on the lines of, just do it. Do you get what I mean?
I think, like, that one's taken, mate.
But, well, in Nike, yeah. But I guess it's one of them where it's like, it's direct play. He's not afraid to take people on. He doesn't overthink anything. If he wants the ball over there, he's hitting it, and he's hitting it hard. And it was just really direct and actually quite refreshing, because it's so different to some of the other styles on the pitch. When he came on, the people around him were a little bit like, oh, okay, we're playing like this now. So I think he had a really good chance late on. And what I really liked was that kind of quick, pacey balls into the box, which you could see the likes of Mateta and the people around him were thinking, oh yeah, more of that. I'll have some more of that. So we weren't able to make a breakthrough, but I think my overview of the game is thus. Henderson might as well have got his hair cut. He didn't do anything. Literally didn't do anything for pretty much the whole game. I don't believe they had a shot on target in the game.
They didn't, no.
Defensively, we looked good, as we normally do. We struggled on the quick break, as I said. I think we've got beef with the ref. The ref. Because I think, honestly, and you know me, I think what we're now, 22 episodes in now.
Yeah.
And I think maybe only once I've had a full-on rant about a ref in a game.
Oh, yeah,
I try not to.
It's mostly UEFA, not the ref.
Yeah. And the reason that I try not to is because, some of you may know this, but I end up having to do it for my son's football team. And I'm normally the one on the receiving end for my appalling decisions when I'm mildly hungover on a Sunday morning trying to run around a football pitch. But I think it was just so frustrating, because it felt like that ref wasn't looking in the right direction for half the game. He was distracted. He was missing, you know, like I said about this whole kind of championship style defending that was going on.
Yeah, okay.
Right? He was always looking the other way when someone hit the deck. But yet, if a Sunderland player went down and did an extra 7 rolls afterwards,
right,
the whistle blew immediately.
Yeah.
And it just felt, and you could just feel the stadium getting more and more irate as it was going on. There was offside flags just weren't going up, and VAR wasn't intervening. There was a clear penalty that I didn't know was a clear penalty at the time, that Glasner mentioned it as well later on in the game. To be honest with you, mate, there was also 2 high kicks to the face. 2 of our defenders got studded in the face.
I did notice
in
that.
In front of the ref.
Yeah.
And he didn't even blow for it. I'm not saying, in fact, do you know what? Yeah, I am. I'm I'm saying that he's not biased. I'm saying he's clueless.
It does sound like a frustrating day, mate. It really does.
It was, but look, 14 shots, six on target. Mm. That just proves, like, there wasn't a lack of creation.
No.
Right? And that's what I got out of this game, which was that, as I said, we lost because of their keeper. We didn't lose because we weren't creating. You got six shots on target in a game. That's not a problem with your build-up play. It's not a problem with your strikers. They've just not hit... Do you know what I mean? It's just not happened.
Yeah. I agree.
Not a single shot on target for Sunderland, which means defence is working. 15 games without a loss in all competitions now, Neil. I know you hate me going on about this, but obviously every week it gets better. And we've maintained our unbeaten start to the new Premier League season. What I haven't had a chance to do, actually, is find out. I'm pretty sure it must still be three teams that are unbeaten, I think, now. Liverpool won today.
Yeah, that's right. So we've got Liverpool. You've got Chelsea, who obviously played yesterday as well. They won, so they haven't lost yet either.
Yeah, so it's just the three of us.
Crystal Palace.
So, which is amazing. And there's some new stats that have been created this week, which is, just to finish off, which is Glasner's now the first ever Palace manager to go 10 Premier League games without defeat. And he's also got the lowest loss percentage of any permanent Palace boss ever. So that, and
that's probably not a tough record to break.
I don't know though, because bearing in mind we finished in the top 10 a couple of times and things like that without him. And also, when, if you go back quite a long time, we used to do all right. But I think he's lost just 16 of his 68 games in charge.
I think it's clear,
Matt,
we are living in an age where Crystal Palace are having their best time. I think that's obviously clear.
Undoubtedly.
You know, without a doubt. So to draw 0-0 with Sunderland is obviously disappointing, but you haven't lost.
Mate,
do you know what I mean?
But do you know what, though?
It could be a lot worse.
But this is what I love about Glasner's philosophy, right? Which is, we didn't lose that game.
Yeah, I agree.
Right? We didn't lose that game. And also, if you have a look at, and by the way, disclaimer, I'm not saying Palace are going to win the Premier League, right? I'm not saying that. But if you look at, like, if you're averaging a point a game, and then every two or three games, you're winning one, say, for example, you're keeping up with the pace of that league, right? People above you aren't getting away from us too much, apart from Liverpool, who are obviously breaking off at the moment. But, like, we are still within the reach of the Europe places. We're in the top half.
Yeah.
Like, we are absolutely keeping up with the pace. So, first objective with any game is don't lose it. And that's why Glasner set up that system like he has. And I promise you now, them new players will get bedded in, got a perfect opportunity midweek with Millwall. And I think we'll be on. So, I'm not concerned.
No.
And also, Palace are very much like Brighton, where you go and absolutely smash a team like Man United, Man City, Tottenham, whatever it is. You come up with the new boys, and for some unknown reason, it's like, I don't know, it's like climbing the biggest mountain or hill ever. Why is that? God knows. But maybe the other teams feel like they're points that they can get. I don't know. But yeah, I'm not disheartened, Neil. Talking of disheartened... Can't wait for this. Do you want me to start the violin music now? I nearly bought my violin, actually.
Oh, no.
Then I realise I don't play one. But yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to sit back and make myself comfortable, Neil, and listen to the sob story. Here we go.
Sob story. Shut your face. So, look, everyone knows the score. We went to the Vitality Stadium and, you know, I don't, Neil.
What was the score?
I said last week in the pod that Brighton's games against Bournemouth, I've always been really close, and I was really surprised by the form, because the form had shown that we'd won like four out of the last five, but it always felt like it was a really close affair. And that, you know, especially the last game, I think Bournemouth probably should have won it. Anyway, so we roll over to Saturday, and yes, Bournemouth 2, Brighton 1.
Oh,
mate. So I was in an airport trying to watch the game, and I managed to find the footage. So I've watched most of the game, lineups wise. So the first thing probably to point out is the fact that our midfield, I'm not sure there's been a bigger age gap in a midfield duo in the Premier League. Can you guess what the age gap was between our two starters on the weekend? The midfield were Jack Inchelwood and James Milner.
Oh, well, Milner's like, what is he, 35 now?
So he's older than that, mate.
No way, is he?
Yeah, he's 39.
Right, 39. He's 2 years younger than me.
Yeah.
He's 2 years younger than me. And he's playing Premier League football.
Yep.
Okay, that's. Yeah. I need to go down the gym.
So 39-year-old James Milner, right? And then you've got.
It's like playing alongside your dad, isn't it? Well, he probably could be.
But that's my point, right?
Could he? How old's Hinjawood?
Well, Hinjawood's 20. So, yeah.
Mate,
practically
wow.
double age. So we had the youngest and the oldest put together, probably, if you think about it, midfielders that we've got in our squad.
And can I ask, does it... And I do this because I try not to watch Brighton games. I have to sometimes for this podcast.
Tell me about
I didn't manage to watch
this. Wish
show.
I'd missed it.
I know. But, like, does it look like there's an age difference? And Milner's legs aren't gone yet, are they?
No, and that's the most amazing thing.
Yeah.
He is the fittest guy I've ever seen. He still wins most of the bleep tests. He is. He's remarkably fit. He's fantastic. And it was a surprise to see them both in the midfield. Not in any bad way. I love seeing Jack Hinchelwood start, but obviously no belabor. He'd come back. He travelled back, though, from Africa, had 2 games for Cameroon. So, you know, with the international break, you always wonder what state players are going to come back with. So there wasn't really a surprise in a shocked way that he didn't start. I mean, it would have been nice for him to start, but at the same time, he hasn't been in brilliant form. So Milner and Hinchelwood was the strange one, the fact that it was both of them.
I think there's more to it than that. Yeah, I'm sure you're probably going to talk about it later.
I think I probably will.
Yeah.
And we had Mitoma, though, started, even though he'd had a long journey. Minte and Rutter behind Danny Welbeck again up front. If you think about last week, game against Man City, 2 weeks ago now, wasn't it? Man City game.
It's a distant memory beating
really
them, wasn't
was.
It?
The biggest difference in that game was obviously when Fabian Hursler put on the four subs and made a huge change to the game. The main change of that was taking players like Danny Welbeck off the pitch and putting on Brajan Gruda and Jorginho Rutter, really both of them as sort of false nines. They took turns really sort of just taking into the position of the nine or the 10 between them. And they were just a ball of energy between them. Fast forward to the Vitality Stadium. And I think having Welbeck up front is starting to show now that it could be a more of a problem than maybe we thought, first of all. And I'll talk about it more later. Weaver. Still not there, still not fit, even though, again, on Thursday, all our players are fit. We'll just check on Weaver. He probably will make the bench, though. No, didn't make the bench either. The only good news I had was the fact that the bench did have our new Greek striker, Simas, and it had Tommy Watson as well. So I was pleased that they made the bench finally.
Wasn't that... I'm sorry if you're going to mention this later, but I'm sure that I saw something on social media about the fact that when Simas made the bench, it was the first time a Greek had ever made the matchday squad at Brighton.
It sounds about right, mate. I actually don't know that one, but I mean, we haven't had many Greek players, so it sounds about right. The first half, look, it could be summed up in about 3 or 4 snapshots, really, the first half. And that is that we were poor, mostly. We had no real rhythm, I think. And the things that stopped us having the rhythm were obviously 2 really bad injuries. Literally 3 minutes into the game, Jack Hinchelwood gets crocked. It really does look like a nasty ankle ligament injury, to be fair.
Oh.
He was really upset, visibly upset on the pitch. I don't know how bad it is. We'll have to wait and see. Yeah. But from the way that he landed on his right ankle, I would imagine he'll be out for quite a few weeks. We will have to wait and see. De Kuyper, left back, running down the wing into the final third as he chases down the ball at about 20 minutes. He has Semenya chasing after him, right? And Semenya decides to push him in his back and push him into the advertising hoardings in the corner of the pitch. I don't understand how someone can get away with that. There's been a few of these recently where players get pushed in the back and they hurt themselves because they're hitting the hoardings. It's exactly what happened. Ref just played on. De Kuyper's off the pitch.
Mm.
He's gone shoulder straight into the advertising hoardings. He's crumpled up in a mess in the corner.
I mean, it's basically assault, right?
Well,
if you did that
point.
Off a football pitch, you get arrested.
I don't understand that.
I don't.
He's nowhere near the ball. He's behind the player with the ball and he just literally pushes him, right? So he's off the pitch and within 30 seconds to a minute of him being off the pitch, guess what happens? Bournemouth score all down that right-hand side, i.e. where De Kuyper should be. We've got Ayari filling in for Hinchelwood because he's off injured, now having to go to left-back to cover De Kuyper, who's off the pitch. I mean, it frustrated me. It was a very unfair start to the game. Having said all of that, I would also say that Bournemouth were probably worth their lead because Brighton were not giving anything in attack. They really weren't. It was a really unhelpful sort of first 20 minutes. They didn't really create too much. Yes, they, as always, as Albion does, when they've got the ball, they'll pass it around nicely. They'll make some good little moves. But you get to the final third and nothing happens, really. Mm-hmm. Minté was probably our brightest spark, as always, because he's quick, because he's something that's explosive. You sort of, your eyes get drawn to him a little bit more and you can see what he's trying to do. And his work rate is always ridiculously high. So I think he was probably our brightest spark, but Jorginho Rutter couldn't really get in the game that much. Welbeck was non-existent. And we've lost two of our first team starters. We've had to make two subs. Therefore, we've only got one window left to make any changes later on in the game. And we go 1-0 down after 25 minutes. And pretty much the rest of the half, nothing really up front. And you know, you sort of go into half time going, what was that? What was that about? It was so disjointed.
Wasn't their goal scored whilst you had 10 men?
That's what I said. Yeah.
And I mean, that's the
like,
but that's the bit of it that I don't understand, because it's like that situation kind of, it didn't happen where they scored, but there was visible frustration yesterday at Selhurst because the referee kind of forgot that Munoz was at the side of the pitch waiting to come back on. Mm-hmm. I think it was Munoz and maybe Pino. And like it took minutes and minutes. The medical team had already walked all the way around back to the dugout, and this guy still stood there the other side of the pitch going, like, what's going on?
There were two...
I thought to myself, what if they'd have gone and scored? I mean, it's a disadvantage for that team, bearing in mind that the other player injures them and then you're at a disadvantage. I think that rule's got to be looked at.
So the whole point of that rule originally was to stop players play acting.
Yeah.
You know, to say if you're injured, you've got to go off the pitch for 30 seconds. I get that. And I understand the concept of that. It's in a good sense that the rule has come about. But if it stops fair, honest players that have just been shoved into the advertising hoardings, why? How is that fair? How is any of that fair? It was a real frustration. And, you know, De Kuyper goes off like 2 minutes. He comes back on the pitch, can't manage it and gets subbed straight away. And that sort of thing is what makes most fans so frustrated when you watch the game. It's like handball rule. It's like the offside rule. There's all these little interpretations. But that rule in particular, to get pushed off the pitch, it's got nothing to do with your fault. It's not nothing. We're not time-wasting 20 minutes into a game. We're not trying to do anything. You can physically see it. You've got VAR. You can see what happened as well.
Yeah.
Why the ref doesn't have a bit of common sense and actually just says, no, hang on. We're stopping the game for a minute, even though he's off the pitch. This is unfair because you're the one that caused this. But for some reason, the referee felt it was okay what Semenyo did. And that's what may be the biggest frustration of the whole lot. Look, we get to half time and it's not a great game, obviously, from our point of view. I don't think we created any shots on target in that first half. And something had to change, but we've already made two changes. We've already used two subs windows. So obviously they have a bit of a conversation at halftime. Hörsler tries to do his thing and rally the troops. And to be fair, they come out in the second half and for the first 12, 15 minutes of that second half, they give it a go. They show up finally, I would argue.
Okay.
And they're a little bit more attacking. Their passing is more crisp and they're really trying to go at it. And literally 3 minutes later, 3 minutes into the second half, we get our goal. Minté down the right-hand side, cuts back onto his left foot. He puts a fantastic whipped cross over to the far post. The keeper tries to sort of go to grab it and misses it because it's going so quick past him. Matoma's on the back post and just nods it into the goal. It was a really lovely, neat little finish for him.
And it did seem to me like the clips, it looks like Matoma and Minta were probably the only two that did turn up in entirety in that game.
I think on an attacking sense, I think Minta in particular was the one that showed up, and he's been showing up all season. You know, he's still not the finished article, so he makes mistakes, but the effort and the want to be right up trying to score the goals and right back trying to defend is fantastic. Matoma's not had a great start to the season. He's been in and out a little bit. And I can almost forgive him being a little bit in and out of this game, having travelled halfway around the world for Japan.
Jet lag.
You know, there's lots of things, lots of reasons why some of the players on the pitch might not be quite right. Look, the second half, we get a goal, it's 1-1, and you're suddenly thinking, okay, well, we haven't played well, but to be 1-1 with almost, you know, an hour gone, I'll take that all day. And the first 15 minutes of that second half, I think it was probably Albion's best spell of the whole game, created a few chances. And then the thing that happens every sort of, you know, 5 or 10 games happened, which is we get full on possession. We're pushing everyone back, putting the defenders and everybody into their half, like we always do. We push right up. Dunk gets the ball, floats out sort of to the left-hand side, left-back area, and really pushing Bournemouth all the way back. And he thinks he's got more time than he's got. He goes to pass the ball back to Van Hek in the centre of the pitch and doesn't see, because he's... I looked on the TV and you can see that he can't see who's in there because of the amount of players that are there. But he passes it across and doesn't weight it right, and suddenly, out of nowhere, Tavernier shows up, intercepts the ball and starts running straight at our goal.
It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing, but it's what Dunk does. And I don't mean this in him personally, but it's the concept of the way that we play. We try and push that team so far back, and we have one central defender staying central, one going far to the left, one right back going all the way to the right. And it's like we're spreading out as much as we can. If we make a wrong pass, suddenly we're so far open.
Yeah, you're in trouble.
Big trouble. And that's what happened. Tavernier got the ball. He runs straight down the middle. And what you then see, though, is the definition of compounding one error with a load of others. Because what you watch then, if you play it back and look at it, and I've looked at it now a couple of times on purpose, specifically for this pod, is when Tavernier, by the time he gets to sort of the edge of the penalty box, there are 5 Brighton and Hove Albion players surrounding him. So there are 5 players, well, 4, because Van Hekker was already back there, 4 players that have steamed right the way back going after him, okay? Which is great. Great work ethic. Good for them. They've gone back. But there is all 5 of them around Tavernier, none of them looking at who else from Bournemouth is around.
They're just going for the player with the
ball. They're going there. They're, honestly, all 5 of them chasing back, and all of them ran to the player with the ball. It was like watching an under-8s game, wow, where they just kick off, swarm all around the ball.
Yeah, like sheep, yeah.
It was unbelievable. Of all the players, Dunk is the one for me that was the worst to blame. He's the furthest away from the ball once he passes it. He's the slowest of the players running back. And still, he chose to run to the player with the ball and not cover the only other Bournemouth player, Evan Nielsen, in our half. That is compounding one error with another. And that's the frustration from my point of view. And that's a little snapshot of what happened last season a few times. Remember when I said about, you know, we concede a goal and you can see that sort of like, oh God, what are we going to do sort of moment. And that's a little bit of a frustration. Look, we weren't terrible, okay? The penalty was conceded. I mean, it was a dodgy penalty. I'm not going to go on about it. Fair enough, it was given, but the touch, I mean, I don't even know if he literally touched him, but, you know, he dived over Van Hek's leg. I can understand why the ref gave it. I can't understand why VAR didn't look at it and go, that's ridiculous. He literally didn't touch him. But the pen goes in, and from then on, really, limited chances. Hörsler makes his final sort of raft of changes that he finally can make. And we get Belaiba, Gruder and Simas come on.
Oh, it's nice of Belaiba to show up.
Exactly. It was lovely of him to show up. But Simas got a run out at least, which is good. He had limited chances though, didn't really get into the game too much. Gruder, same again, didn't really get into the game too much.
How long did they have? Did you say 15
they
minutes?
They had 25 minutes.
Oh, well, look, at least your substitutes get longer than the Palace ones. Like, at least, I mean, 25 minutes is giving someone a shot, isn't it?
I agree. Totally agree with you. You know, and the only thing that Simas did do that I think, you know, he shows promise, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it's difficult for the lad just to come in and suddenly be our saviour. He was quick, he was working hard, he came deep a few times, but mostly wanted to be on the shoulder of the defender and get in behind. And I think we need that. We need that to be able to stretch the play away from our midfielders who want the ball so much. So Longer term, yeah, look, great. Great for him to get a run out, his first Premier League debut. And as I say, Gruder, belabor. Now, honestly, he looks like he's regressed since the Man United talk has all happened. I think it's clearly affected him. And in this game, he just looks a little lost. His concentration isn't there. Some people have been saying that maybe he looks a bit like he's trying too hard. And then the next minute, it's almost like he's trying to maybe win the manager over again, which might be the case, to be fair. You know, he's thinking he has to do something, but he's looking a little bit like a lost puppy in that midfield.
Well, I mean, he's a young kid, Neil, who got his head turned, got told that he was going to get his wages double, triple, quadruple, whatever. Yeah. And how old is he?
He's 21, that's all.
Okay, so he's still a young lad.
Yeah.
And you think about it and you go, look, Man United, even though dismal and probably better to stay at Brighton these days, but still one of the biggest clubs in the world. They turned his head, and even your manager, I listened to that interview, who, by the way, your manager sounded like a broken man after that game. He very clearly said that Belieber had his head turned, and that it's clear that his head wasn't in the game, which I think why he only got put on it as a substitute, and also why he's not performing to where he was. The truth of the matter is, mate, and you held no punches with this Gaye situation with me, so I feel like I can be honest with you. Mate, you should have sold him. You should have sold him.
No,
you should have got your money for him.
No.
Because at the moment, I don't think he's playing for that badge. I think he's got the hump with that badge. I think he feels like you're holding him back.
No, I don't think it's that. I don't think he's got the hump. I don't think it's that at all. I understand
he could have had him.
No, I agree. He's 21 years old and he's had his head turned. I completely agree with all of that.
Yeah.
I don't think now, though, it's about him downing tools. Because when you watch
him, it's
like
a mental thing. It's a mental thing to go, I could be doing that now.
No,
I could
don't
be
think it's
that now.
I think his head isn't in the game at this moment. And I think what he's done, I saw it a little bit at the beginning of last season. And he took a while to get up to speed. And I think what's happened this season is Hertzler hasn't been arm around the shoulder going, we love you, we think you're great. He's gone. You wanted to go to Man United. You're now here. We've told you you're staying. What are you going to do about it? Prove to me you're good enough to play. And suddenly that difference of almost a stick rather than a carrot has had a little bit of an effect on him, I think. And you can see it. He's a little bit lost. He's not quite sure what to do. His concentration levels aren't there. And he needs to turn it around pretty quick. And if he's got that mindset, he's definitely not ready for Man United. Because the amount of stick that people get at Man United, that he wouldn't last 5 minutes. So this is a little window into his mentality and he needs to do something quick. And it's on him. It's not on anyone else. When he turns up and plays on that pitch, it's on him. Yes, he's a young lad, but he's proved that he can be great.
Oh, he has proved he can be great.
So he needs to now think about what made him great last season and try and get back to that form. And all that is hard work and trying to get his mind straight. Look, overall, going back to the game, it wasn't terrible. It was disjointed and probably not helped, obviously, by losing those two starters in the first 25 minutes. As always, with a game against Bournemouth, it was really tight. Albion had 49% possession, but we only had two shots on target. As I said, very similar to the other away games and the other games where we've played at the beginning of this season, where overall, if you look at the midfield and defence, not too bad. Up front, not creating enough, not incisive enough. And, you know, I'm not too upset by the game. It was close, but there's a long way to go. We do need to start to get a fit and firing attack in some way. And the two losses are two away games as well. That's another thing to consider.
Yeah.
That when we are away, there's a different mindset maybe that's needed. And at the moment, we haven't quite found what that is. And last but not least, Andy, what I would say is, look, you know, Hertzler, he's been talking a good game all summer. He's been out there talking to the press, having lots of chats, doing lots of nice press about everything. When things are going well, he sounds great and intelligent and positive about this is the way forward and things. And to be fair to him, last season, when things weren't going great, he was good as well. But right now, it's very clear that there's still a lot of hard work needed to see Albion at their best. And honestly, I think we are still a fair few weeks, possibly months, away from seeing this real consistent performance levels that we're after. But I'm not panicking yet.
I prefer not to speak. If I speak, I will be in trouble.
Welcome back to Seagull Eagle podcast. I've convinced Neil to cheer up and carry on after his dismal match review, bless him. Are you all right now?
Yes, I'm fine. Okay. There's a long season ahead.
It's all right.
I'm going to try and stay as positive as I can.
I mean, it's not a new feeling for you, is it? So you'll be all right. You'll be all right. Let's talk about chirpier things. Is there anything else going on at Brighton at the moment?
Well, I wouldn't say it was chirpier news, but we did get some news about David Weir, who is our technical director, or was our technical director, as he officially leaves the club this week.
Has there been a falling out, Neil?
I don't think there has, from what I understand. I mean, if you think about who David Weir is, obviously, those of an older inclination will know that he used to be a very good central defender. Scotland, Everton, there's a few other teams he played for, moved into coaching, did a few things there. And then, assistant technical director. I think, first of all, he joined Brighton as development manager. So he's someone who was looking after the kids who were loaned out and seeing how they do. That was in 2018. Then he moved to assistant technical director and then became the club's technical director in May 22 when Dan Ashworth left.
So he's departed. So when are Chelsea announcing him?
Yeah, exactly. Tony Bloom, I wanted to read out these quotes. He said, David has served our club very well, but we now wish to refresh our technical area with new leadership and direction. I'd like to thank David for everything he has done for us, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, Neil, hang on a minute.
Yeah, go on.
That's not David going, I'm moving on.
No.
That's Mr. Bloom going, past
as
new.
Yeah, it's time for a change.
That's now, a bit unfortunate that he had to do that. You don't have to put a statement out like that.
Well, I think it probably
could at least
stops.
Pretend that he's decided to move on.
No, I don't think that's in Brighton's way. I think they want to make sure that it's shown as a positive from a Brighton point of view. It's not like David's decided to leave. They've just decided it's the end of the road. And it happens a lot in football. Technical directors do move on because they're in charge of things like transfer policies and strategies and things like that. And after a cycle, their time is up and the club might want to make a change. And there is a lot of gossip around as to who it's going to be. But I believe my understanding is that it's actually going to be a gentleman by the name of Jason Ayto, A-Y-T-O, Jason Ayto, who was the former Arsenal assistant sporting director. So he worked under Edu when he was there at Arsenal over the last few years. He was promoted into the position of interim sporting director when Edu left because he went off to Nottingham Forest. He didn't get the job full time, though. That was given to someone else. He was rumoured to be Newcastle were rumoured to be interested in him as well. It shows a desire to change the way that we're doing things and go in a different direction, as Tony Bloom has said. And it's clearly a very different direction, I think, because it's showing maybe that we have an intent to look a little bit higher in calibre of player. But that hasn't been official yet, the Jason Ayto news. But I'm expecting it to happen in the next week or so. So we'll have to wait and see on that one. But yeah, look, David Weir, been fantastic for the club. He's done a great job, great servant. And we wish him well.
Well, I'm sure he has made you a lot of money over the years.
Yeah. He has. And he's been in charge of looking over and looking after a lot of different players over his years. So, he's been great for the club and we do wish him well. And when Jason comes in, if it is him, then I'm sure we'll hear some quotes from him about the next strategy and what they want to do with the club. It'll be interesting to see.
Very much so.
How about Palace? They got any news? Anything going on?
There's a couple of bits of news.
Go on. I'm going to sip my coffee while you talk to me.
Well, look, we've had, even though the transfer window's shut, we have had an extra person go out on loan. So we've had, I don't know if you remember us talking about Rak-Saki.
Yes, the Yonkity, yeah.
We knew that he was going to go out. And obviously when the window closed in the UK, it was a bit like, oh, hang on a minute. He's not gone anywhere.
Yeah.
But it has now been announced that he's gone to a Turkish club.
Oh, okay. Are you going to announce who they are?
KK Rizapur.
Excuse me?
Cake or rice pour?
Right, okay.
Fluent in Turkish, so yeah. I know that is bang on, by the way.
Brilliant, love it.
I went on holiday there once, so I'm all good. Were they? I don't know if you know, Neil, but they finished ninth in the top flight that
right.
season.
Okay.
So they're very much kind of a mid-table club out in Turkey. Is it a good move for him? I think it is. I think he just needs to go somewhere and play first-team football.
I was going to say, it's just game time, isn't it? You just need to play.
That's all it is. He's gone to championship clubs, and I think this is now probably the next step for him. It's also to keep his value, because I just can't see him hitting our first team, but let's see.
Okay.
We've also made an appointment. We've got a new CEO.
Oh, see, everyone's doing it. All these different appointments, the back staff.
Well,
yeah, go on.
We've had a bit of a... We've had no one in that role for a little while, actually, and we've actually appointed our previous head of operations, who's now returned to the role of CEO, Sharon Lacey.
Right.
She worked at Palace for 15 years prior to leaving to go on to be CEO for another football club last year. She's now come back to our club, and I think it's a good appointment, actually, because it's someone who, as I say, she was previously head of operations. She was in charge of the project for the new stand and the development and all that kind of stuff. Her big kind of challenge and focus going forward is to get that project started and over the line. I think we have had a lack of people in leadership positions getting stuff done that isn't football recently. Yeah. So I'm hoping that will be something that happens in this new stand gets started, which I genuinely hope to see in my lifetime, Neil. Because I
do
think
they have a date on it then?
It was meant to have started a couple of years ago. Then we heard works were going to start over the winter here. Still nothing happened. We've now heard potentially it's going to be 2027 that it's completed.
Wow.
So you would hope that if you're going to finish it by 2027, it's got to start soon. I know they've done a few groundworks and things like that, but there we go. And that's part of the main reason why I moved over to the main stand, Neil, because I want a seat in that new...
I don't blame you.
New thing, because I want a bit of legroom.
That's good thinking. Very good thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I didn't want to sit with the away fans. The other thing I did want to talk about is because you've been very vocal, mate. You've been very vocal about this Gaye situation and how Palace... potentially didn't deal with it correctly, how Glasner was about to walk out. And I said
last week, I just said, because you were making the point that apparently everybody wins in that situation, and I was simply saying that if it got that late in the window and we still weren't sure what was going on, because there were deals going on, there were deal sheets, all this sort of stuff, that there must have been some strained relationships between, in particular, the manager, Glasner, and probably whoever's in charge of transfers, which I imagine is Steve Parish. But that was my point.
Yeah, and I think the issue is that, and you know, because I talked about, you know, the media and the effect and all that kind of stuff last week, and I think this is the problem, which is that people have reported stuff that isn't true. Other people add other bits and pieces that aren't true. And Glasner's sat at the press conference before the Sunderland game.
Oh, right.
And been directly asked about, did he threaten to leave the club if Gaye was sold, which was widely reported.
Well, he's not going to say yes, is he now?
Well, I think that he can. I think that he was very clear. He was like, and I've got a quote from him, right? He's basically said, number one, I never threatened to leave the club, never. Number two, he advised that they should not sell Gaye, which he already said.
Yep.
And he said, big credit to the chairman, who I didn't have to threaten. Right. And I genuinely do believe this. I do believe this. There was no tensions between the chairman and myself. It was really just a discussion about sports. And big credit to him, he decided against the money and for the sporting perspective of Crystal Palace.
Andy.
It's that clear.
Andy, if it was big credit to the chairman, if there was no tensions between the chairman and that, why the hell at 10 to 5 in the evening of the transfer deadline was a deal sheet put together for Mark Gaye? Why did you have a leavers video recorded? Why was all that happening?
Well, none of that means that there was any tension between
It means that Palace were very happy to sell him.
No,
they were ready.
It means,
and that means they weren't listening to Glasner up until 5 to 5 in the evening.
Well, no, this is the difference, though, because Glasner said, unless two defenders are signed... Basically, there's a lot of a longer quote here, but in essence, what he was talking about was that JD Canvo, who we signed, is a 19-year-old kid, and he's going to be brilliant. He's one of the best up-and-coming central defenders. But Glasner says that you can't put someone who's got, like, I don't know, a couple of hundred hours worth of first team football up against someone like Gay, who's got thousands, and that would be detrimental to the club. So what Glasner's stance on it was is a good experienced central defender comes in before the deadline, we shouldn't sell him, right? And obviously that didn't happen. And Steve Parish, once he'd finished his gym workout on the transfer deadline day, sorted it all out. There was also loads of speculation to say that Gay-he wasn't... No one spoke to Gay-he or his family and all the other bits and pieces, mostly written by Liverpool fans. the truth of the matter was that he was spoken to. Glasner spoke to him at length because he was already at the England camp and all the other bits and pieces. And also, I mean, look at the media, man. They went mad on all this because it's against the run of play when a big club like Liverpool doesn't get their way, right? So therefore, it was all about Mark Gay-he's going to threaten to... He's threatened not to be Palace captain.
Hang on.
At no point has Gay-he said...
I wouldn't be doing my job here if I didn't ask this question. Explain to me this. What do you think, because I appreciate you don't know, but what do you think, having understood what all the comments and all the quotes and not listening to the media, because it's got nothing to do with them apparently.
Well, it has got something to do with them if they report the facts.
Andy, at what point do you think Mark Gay-he knew he was not leaving Crystal Palace?
Probably at about 3:30, 4:00.
So with an hour left of the transfer window, he finally gets told he's not leaving Crystal Palace.
Well, he knew.
But it's all been okay up till then.
No.
Everything's fine. And Glasner just talks to him at 4 p.m. and suddenly goes, yeah, no, it's not happening.
No.
And Mark Gay-he goes, oh, okay, boss, yeah, no worries. Love you. Bye.
That's not what happened. Well, it was being widely reported inside the club and it was talked about again this week from many different parties, which is why Gay-he has come back and dealt with it as he has, because the club did deal with it correctly. They told Gay-he that there was a chance that he wouldn't be moving. If the rest of the world, Neil, if the rest of the world can read all this stuff in the media about is he, isn't he, surely Gay-he would know there's a chance is he, isn't he. Do you know what I mean? Like, is it going or is he not going? Gay knew that there was a chance he wouldn't go and it was dependent on another defender coming in.
Yeah.
There were communications done. I think that it's just this whole kind of, it's great because there's a story and there's loads to report on it and it's just all of that. But ultimately, there was a player that could go under certain conditions. Those conditions didn't materialise. And there was no falling out, unfortunately. Gay's happy to be captain. That was proved on Saturday when he bossed that game once again. He turned up at the England camp with his head screwed on and scored a goal again, 2 goals in 2 games. Like, how is that guy, you know, at the bottom of a barrel, depressed because he's not going to play for Liverpool? Ultimately, that guy's going to get a move to Real Madrid, Bayern Munich. Mate, he's going to go to a massive, massive club and he's going to win from that. I promise you now. I think drama's over. Let's all stop talking about Gay. And I'm looking forward to Googling Crystal Palace and not coming up with 50 million stories about one bloke. Boring.
Well, let's talk about what's on the pitch then instead. Let's talk about the games ahead.
Yes.
Keep it quick. We've got about 5 minutes left of this. So let's just talk through the... Well, you've got 2 games this week, haven't you?
Yeah.
So you've got a League Cup game first.
Yeah, we've got Carabao Cup. Are you not playing till next week then?
We're not playing till next week, yes. So we've got a week off, thankfully, to lick our wounds. So Palace have got Millwall.
Yeah, round 3, Millwall again. Tuesday night, 8 o'clock. For those of you listening that maybe don't get down there very often to watch a game, they are on general sale.
Wow.
I can't sell
the tickets.
Well, I think there's a lot of Palace fans that are doing a lot of travelling and buying a lot of European packages and things like this. So there's probably... That never normally happens. But no, they are on general sale.
It's a shame. Can't sell out.
Mate, you're still selling season tickets and that is a fact, Neil Sharp.
Empty stadium.
Second time we've met them this year. Beaten 1-0 in a pre-season friendly. Previously met in the FA Cup last season in March where we won 3-1 when Mateta got potential murdered.
Yep.
Glasner's already hinted at 3 or 4 changes in the
post-match. You can only make about 3 or 4, can't you?
Yeah. I think that we'll get Uche and Canvo potentially on that pitch.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's going to make more than 3 or 4 changes because I think he's going to want to get them new players in with the other players around them.
Yeah.
So I think that what we see for Millwall could be given a couple of people a chance, but mostly trying to shape the future without Sarr for a little bit. And Walton's only out for, they reckon, maybe another couple of weeks. It's not as bad as what they thought it was. So he's definitely out for that one.
Prediction for that one?
2-0 win. yeah.
Fair enough.
Who have you got? You've got Spurs over
there. So, yeah, we've got
Saturday.
No midweek game, as we said. And then Saturday, we've got Spurs at home, so at the Amex. I'm not going to predict anything. I haven't got a clue. As always, you know, we never know. What I would say is, stats-wise, so we've won three of the last four games against Spurs. Obviously, last game of the season last year, we...
That's a good stat.
4-1 away. At home, we had the game. I don't know if you remember the game, but it was a huge comeback. We were 2-0 down at half-time and then came back to win 3-2 in the second half.
I do remember that.
It's a very different Spurs side last season to it is this season. I think we all know that and we can see that. And so it will be an incredibly tough game. The only thing I'm clinging on to is that Spurs have Champions League this week and they are playing on Tuesday at home to Villarreal. So maybe I might get a little bit of a second string team against Brighton. Maybe they might be a bit tired. I don't know. I'm clutching at straws, let's be honest.
Sounds like it.
I'd be happy with a point. That's all I'll say. What about you? What have you got on?
We've got West Ham.
Ooh. Right, okay.
Who are my favourites to get relegated?
I mean, they're practically relegated now, aren't they? Jeez.
I mean, I don't even know how Potter's still there, to be fair.
They can't afford to sack him, I'd imagine.
Yeah, probably. I mean, look, they've got 3 points from four games. They've conceded 11 goals so far, the most of any team. That was up until today. That might have changed with today's games. But winless in 7 Premier League games at the London Stadium, that's a hell of a fact. It's that stadium was the worst thing they've ever done. It's their worst home run since 2003-0. So we are kind of playing them at the right time. We beat them 2-0 in January, obviously, yeah, last season. Do you know what? We've played each other 28 times, right? And we won 10 each.
Oh, really?
So whoever wins this one...
Blimey. Okay.
...gets the upper hand. I think we should get a win at West Ham. I really, really do.
Oh, I agree. I think anyone should at the moment, the way they're playing. So
I think if we don't, it's lost points.
Yeah,
because
I agree.
Think we've already lost 2 points against Sunderland if we're going to keep up with everything. So, yeah, hopefully we'll get a win. But obviously, we're still playing them 2 games a week at the moment. It's going to continue. So, yeah, let's see who else gets injured.
Okay, mate, fair enough. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for another episode of Seagull Eagle. Thank you very much for listening.
Make sure to follow the show so you don't miss the next episode when it drops. We'll be back next week to review Brighton v Spurs and West Ham v Palace and have a little look at that Millwall game as well.
You can find us on TikTok, Instagram and the Facebook, also on X. Do us a favour, search Seagull Eagle and get the conversation started.
Or you could drop us that little email if you want at seagulleaglepodcast@gmail.com.
But in the meantime, we'll see you next week. And until then, Seagulls!